right here on VOA1. The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Today, you will hear reports from Brian Lynn, Katie Weaver, and Anna Mateo. Jonathan presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us the next part of our series, America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Myanmar's ruling military has executed 4 democracy activists whom the government had accused of carrying out terror acts. The government confirmed Monday it had completed the executions, the first to be carried out in the country in more than 40 years. The action led to widespread condemnation from human rights groups and members of the international community. The 4 men were accused of helping a resistance movement fight Myanmar's military government. They were sentenced to death during trials held in January and April. They were activists. The trials were not open to the public. The military took power on February 1st. The seizure came just as lawmakers were to take their seats in parliament. Elections had been held the November before. Military officials said the election was dishonest and the overthrow was necessary as a result. The country's electoral commission had rejected the army's claims of wrongdoing. Among those executed was democracy campaigner Cha Min-yu, better known as Ko Jimmy, the country's Global New Light of Myanmar newspaper reported. The 53-year-old was a longtime democracy activist in the country. He had already spent more than 12 years in detention for political activism before his arrest in Yangon last October. Cha Min-yu had been put on a wanted list for social media postings that the military government claimed led to unrest. State media said he was accused of terrorist acts, including mine attacks and heading a militant group called the Moonlight Operation. Also executed was 41-year-old Pyo Zaya Tha, a former lawmaker and hip-hop music artist. The government ordered his arrest in November based on information from people detained for shooting at security force members, state media reported at the time. Pyo Zaya Tha was a close ally of Myanmar's ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi. He was jailed in 2008 under a past military government after being accused of having illegal contacts and owning foreign currency. The 2 others executed were Hla Myo Aung and Aung Tura Za. Both of them were sentenced to death in April for the March killing of a woman accused of being an informant for the military, the army chief said in an online statement. Aung Myo Min is the human rights minister for the National Unity Government. The group is a civilian administration established outside of Myanmar after the military seized power. The organization rejected the accusations that any of the men executed were involved in violence. Punishing them with death is a way to rule the public through fear, Ong Myo Min told the Associated Press. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar said it mourned the loss of the four men and expressed sorrow to their families. I'm Brian Lin.
Mennonite farming communities in southern Mexico are becoming a concern for the Mexican government. They are clearing areas of the Maya forest, the largest tropical forest in North America. Mennonites are Christians who live a simple life and reject some modern technology, including cars, televisions, radios, and other electronic devices. Global Forest Watch is a nonprofit organization that looks at deforestation. It said the Maya forest is shrinking every year by nearly 900 square kilometers. The Mennonites say that expanding their farms to provide a simple life for their families is the will of God. Isaac Dyke Thiessen is a farmer and leader in the Mennonite settlement of Chavi. He said his people want to be left in peace. Mennonites expanded into remote parts of Mexico after first arriving from Canada in the early 20th century. Agriculture work is central to their way of life and their religious beliefs. The Mexican government once welcomed their farming expertise. But the Mennonites' farms are causing environmental problems in the Maya forest, one of North America's biggest carbon sinks, and a home to endangered jaguars. A carbon sink is an area with a strong ability to take in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. When they are not working, Mennonites do not use electricity and other modern technology. However, their farming has developed to include machinery like bulldozers and chainsaws to clear land, as well as tractors and harvesters for their crops. Mennonites arrived in Mexico's Campeche state in the 1980s. In the last 20 years, nearly one-fifth of the state's tree cover has been lost. The Mennonites keep an uneasy peace with local native communities. The native or indigenous Maya communities guard the surrounding forest, but also borrow equipment from Mennonites for their own land. With them, we began to have access to machinery. We see that it gives us results, said Wilfredo Chikov, a Maya farmer. Such access, however, has harmed the Maya forest. Between 2001 and 2018, the three states that make up the forest in Mexico lost about 15,000 square kilometers of tree cover. This is driving a shorter rainy season. Less forest means less rainfall capture. Mennonites are not the only ones harming the forest. Other groups, including palm oil farmers and cattle ranchers, also carry out widespread land clearance. Last August, the government urged Campeche Mennonite settlements to sign an agreement to stop deforesting land. Not all the communities signed. Leader Dyke Thiessen and a lawyer representing some communities and farmers said Mennonites felt attacked by the government's efforts. Mennonites believe in taking a pacifist approach to conflict. Pacifists oppose war or violence as a way of dealing with disputes. The lawyer said at one meeting last year, a senior official at the Federal Environment Ministry warned villagers the military could be brought to the area to stop deforestation if the communities did not change their ways. Reuters reporters asked the Environment Ministry about the official's comments. The ministry denied talking about using the military, saying the government operates peacefully. Carlos Tacuch is head of the Campeche Office of Mexico's National Forestry Commission. He told Reuters the government was not only centered on the Mennonites. The government, he said, was also looking into other causes of deforestation. I'm Katie Weaver.
International media and music companies want to sell products from Africa's music market. African music is increasingly popular on the internet and on smartphones in places far outside of Africa. Companies are noticing a worldwide interest in African music. The company Universal Music Group launched Virgin Music Africa Label and Artist Services in June. It aims to support independent African music recording companies, often called labels, and artists. The service will digitize music catalogs or collections of songs coming from the same owner that are no longer available to buyers. The company aims to expand into the growing market for African sounds. The interest from international companies is growing as African artists become the main performers at international music events, like festivals and concerts. Festivals include AfroNation in Portugal and Africolor in France. African musical forms such as Afrobeat, Rumba, and Amapiano are topping popular music lists known as charts. Frank Alsikaku is managing director of Universal Music Africa and the new Virgin Music Africa label. He said it has over 15,000 music titles or songs. Kaku added that it has 50 partner labels and around 100 artists from 25 countries. The artists include Senegal's Mbalax Maestro Youssou N'Dour, Congo's Lukua Kanza, Magic System from Ivory Coast, and Cabo Snoop from Angola. Kaku said that the service will digitize and make available African music currently in music media like vinyl, cassette, or CD. The aim is to reach younger listeners. I'm Ana Mateo.
U.S. health officials recently reported that drug-resistant infections increased during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic. The report came from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It said there was an increase in hospital infections and deaths in 2020. Dr. Arjun Srinivasan, a CDC expert, called it a startling reversal that he hopes was a one-year happening. CDC officials think there were several reasons for the rise. One was how COVID-19 was treated when it first appeared in the United States in early 2020. Antimicrobial drug resistance happens when organisms like bacteria and fungi gain the ability to resist the drugs that were designed to kill them. The misuse of antibiotics was a big reason for the increase, officials said. Unfinished or unnecessary prescriptions that did not kill the microorganisms made them stronger. Before the pandemic, health officials said U.S. drug-resistant infections appeared to be going down. Deaths fell from an estimated 44,000 in 2012 to 36,000 in 2017, an 18% decrease. The government credited hospitals for the careful use of antibiotics and for separating patients who might spread infections. The CDC does not have 2020 data for all infectious diseases. But it does have information on 7 kinds of bacterial and fungal infections that were found in hospital patients. They include MRSA and a bacterium called CRE, which is known as the nightmare bacteria. The CDC reported increases of 15% or more in infections and deaths from that group of microorganisms. From March to October 2020, almost 80% of patients hospitalized with COVID-19 received an antibiotic, CDC officials said. Use of certain kinds of antibiotics increased as doctors used many kinds of drugs to fight both the coronavirus and any bacterial co-infections. By 2021, use of antibiotics dropped. Dr. Srinivasan noted that the use of catheters, ventilators, and other medical devices might also be down. Those devices are used on very sick patients and can be a means for drug-resistant microbes to enter patients' bodies. Any increase in COVID-19 hospitalizations, like the one being seen in the U.S. currently, increases that risk, he said.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about James Buchanan, the 15th President of the United States. He was the third in a series of unsuccessful presidents. Millard Fillmore and Franklin Pierce had failed to resolve the country's increasing division over slavery. Democratic Party officials hoped Buchanan could do better. After all, he was a gifted lawyer and had been a member of the U.S. Congress, a Secretary of State, and a diplomat. But Buchanan was not so sure he could resolve the country's problems. He was right. He was the last president before the American Civil War. James Buchanan was born in the northern state of Pennsylvania. His father was a businessman, and his family was financially successful. Buchanan, the oldest son in a family with 11 children, received a good education. He attended Dickinson College in Pennsylvania and soon began working as a lawyer. His abilities earned him a good deal of money and a place in the state's legislature, but they were not able to win him a wife. As a young man, Buchanan fell in love with and proposed marriage to a young woman from a wealthy family. She accepted, but her father opposed the union. One day, his fiancée wrote Buchanan a letter saying she had reconsidered and decided not to marry him after all. 3 days later, she unexpectedly died. Buchanan was heartbroken. He promised never to marry anyone else, and he did not. To date, James Buchanan is the only U.S. president who never married. When he entered the White House, his niece served as his first lady. Even with problems in his personal life, Buchanan went on to have a strong career as a national politician. He hoped his party would nominate him as its candidate for president. But in the 1840s and early 1850s, the Democrats nominated other candidates. Finally, in 1856, the party chose Buchanan. But by then, he was no longer sure he wanted to be president. He believed the country would soon be at war. Violence had already broken out in the western territory of Kansas. White settlers there had clashed over whether Kansas would enter the Union as a slave or free state. In one dramatic event, an anti-slavery activist named John Brown had murdered several pro-slavery settlers. President Buchanan had clear ideas about slavery. He said in his inaugural speech that voters in the territories, a group made up of white men, should be able to decide the issue for themselves. In the same speech, Buchanan urged Americans to support an important Supreme Court ruling that became known as the Dred Scott decision. 2 days later, the court's justices announced the majority opinion in that case. The opinion said the federal government did not have the power to control slavery in the territories. In addition, the court declared that enslaved people were not U.S. citizens. They were property, it said. Enslaved people did not have any more rights than a horse or a chair. Buchanan hoped the decision would stop the country's debate over slavery. Instead, it made the debate even more intense. During his presidency, Buchanan took two other actions that increased tensions and damaged his public image. First, he tried to persuade Congress to accept a state constitution for Kansas. The Constitution permitted slavery, although a majority of Kansas voters had not agreed to it. The U.S. House of Representatives decided not to follow President Buchanan's wishes. They permitted Kansans to vote again on the Constitution. This time, Kansas voters rejected it. A majority agreed instead to seek admission into the Union as a free state. Buchanan's image also suffered because of an event known as the Raid on Harper's Ferry. The raid was led by John Brown, the anti-slavery activist who had murdered pro-slavery settlers in Kansas. This time, Brown hoped to create an armed rebellion of anti-slavery activists and freed slaves. To get weapons, Brown and his men attacked a federal arsenal about 110 kilometers northwest of Washington, D.C. The armory was in the town of Harper's Ferry, in today's state of West Virginia. President Buchanan answered the raid by permitting federal troops to use force. The U.S. Marines surrounded Brown and his forces. They killed some and captured others, including Brown. A few weeks later, Brown was brought to trial, found guilty, and hanged. The event further divided Americans. Anti-slavery Northerners believed Brown was a hero. Pro-slavery Southerners believed he was a traitor. In general, Buchanan agreed with the Southerners. He said in a speech that Northerners should not tell Southerners what they could do in their states. But his words did not satisfy either side. For one thing, a main issue was whether slavery should be permitted in any new states. Buchanan did not comment on that point. At the end of his single term, Buchanan kept an earlier promise not to seek re-election. His party did not urge him to. Instead, Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats split. They nominated two different candidates. The Democrats' lack of unity provided an opening for a candidate from a new party. The Republican Party was comprised of Northerners who were against slavery. Their candidate was a lawyer without much experience in government. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln won the presidential election of 1860. In answer, the southern state of South Carolina withdrew from the Union. Buchanan, who was in the last weeks of his presidency, did not support the move, but he did not act to stop South Carolina either. He said the Constitution did not give him the power to force a state to stay in the Union. Following Buchanan's inaction, six other slaveholding southern states also seceded. Today, many historians agree James Buchanan was one of the worst American presidents. Buchanan had many good personal qualities, and he did not want to harm the country. Instead, a common belief is that he did not have the right skills to unite a divided nation. His behavior appeared to be guided by conflicting ideas. Buchanan said he opposed slavery and supported the Union, but he often took actions to protect slavery and help the South. Buchanan largely blamed anti-slavery activists and opposition politicians for the problems during his administration. But the public did not accept Buchanan's position. He was not respected after he left office, and he did not appear in public very often. Instead, the former president withdrew to his home in Pennsylvania until his death in 1868. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.